Reading from Canto 1, Chapter 1, Texts number 19 and 20. So Chapter 1 of Canto 1 is Questions by the Sages. In the chapter, there are several things that are covered. Besides the invocation mantras, can we crack the window and get a little air? Besides the invocation mantras, that explained what the whole Srimad Bhagavatam is about. There's a description of the qualifications of a speaker of Srimad Bhagavatam and the qualifications of a receiver of the Bhagavatam's message. So that's done in the form of the sages honoring Sutta, saying what his qualifications are. Sutta appreciating their questions and their enthusiasm and so forth. So the qualifications of a receiver. So that in the context of narration of a history, we get teachings. What's the qualification to speak? What's the qualification to receive Srimad Bhagavatam's message? Then they start their questions. And the questions that are found in the first canto, chapter 1, make up the subject of the next two chapters, where the answers are found. Chapter 2 and chapter 3 are the answers. But then, by going through this question and answer thing, the subject matter in these first three chapters is simply expanded upon to the whole of the Srimad Bhagavatam, like a thread, like, you know, in the cloth on the floor here. There's a thread, but the thread isn't just, you know, going from one side to the other side. There's threads that go across, and there's patterns. These not this is one color, but patterns of color. The Bhagavatam is composed like that also. The idea that's over here resonates or is expanded by some explanation over here and is amplified and embellished by something over here. When you become familiar with the Bhagavatam, it's like a grand symphony of composition. Beautiful, brilliant. Besides, the poetry of the Bhagavatam is wonderful. The messages of the Bhagavatam are very so nicely composed. So, by studying very carefully the first three chapters, one can understand, in essence, the whole Bhagavatam. These, you know, the little sound bites, the little, like, core messages. And so, the questions, there's six questions, they're commented upon by our acharyas, like, a lot. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has identified what are the questions and what are the answers found within these first three chapters. Jiva Goswami has done the same thing. Baladeva Dibhusan has done the same thing. So it's really nice, something that a service that Bhurijan has done, as he's gone through those commentaries and in his first four cantos, when it was Under His Lotus Feet or something like that is the title of the book, he's gleaned what some of those commentaries are, and it really helps appreciating, I find at least, it really helps appreciating what's this subject matter. So the the first four questions have been covered up to the verses that we're reading this morning. First question is, what is the essence of all the Vedas concisely described? Because people of this age are misguided, unfortunate, disturbed, diminished duration of life. They're so disqualified. There's no way that they're going to understand what the essence is, but you know what the essence is. Can you concisely state it? Great question. Then the next one is related, but it's different. What's the all-around best thing for all people in all times and all circumstances, especially somebody like me who's about to die? What's the all-around best thing? Then another is presented more as a statement, but later is going to be an explicit question. You know the reason why he who created this cosmic manifestation enters into it. Then it's, so the question is, why does Krishna descend? What's the reason for Krishna's descent into this world? And then the next is, can you please describe those transcendental activities of the Supreme Lord who enters into this world and shows himself in various forms? And there's a whole bunch of verses glorifying the glorious pastimes of the Lord in his various forms and how they're fully transcendental. So the verses this morning are covering, again, that topic. It's already been discussed, but 19 and 20 are discussing the transcendental nature of Krishna's appearance. Although it appears ordinary, it's fully transcendental. Krishna and his form and his pastimes are fully transcendental. And the attractiveness of those pastimes, that is not like the attraction of senses to sense objects of this mundane plane. This is like a prelude to the answers that it comes in the first canto, or first chapter, and it's said several times in the second chapter, this phrase, yenatma suprasediti, or yayatma suprasediti, which means, prasanna means happiness or satisfaction, and suprasanna means very completely satisfied. So how the soul can become completely satisfied, because everybody wants to be satisfied. I don't know anybody that would say, I don't want to be satisfied. But to actually experience that means detachment from all other things. Like, all other things. No other thing can grab a hold of one's attention if one is within fully satisfied. And that, from that fully satisfied position, then one can see things as they are. Not, I like it, I don't like it, attraction, repulsion, be, you know, situated in duality. One can be like Krishna, the seer of all things, yet detached from all things. One can be a transcendentalist moving about in the world by that suprasana. So the sages in text 19, they're saying, we know that you've got the goods. You can deliver the goods. You're a transcendentalist that knows all about the forms of the Lord. Please describe them, because we want to experience that which you're experiencing. And you can deliver it. This happiness that is so filling, so satisfying, that detachment from worldliness is automatically going to follow. In fact, that's what the Bhagavatam is giving, And it's what the sages are describing you, Sutta Goswami. You can present that. You heard from, so back to what they said earlier, you not only heard from Shukadeva Goswami, but you understood everything that he said. And not only you understood everything that he said, but you fully realized it. You're a walking Bhagavatam. So please deliver. Oh, Sutta. In fact, they're so excited they say it. Sutta, Sutta, Mahabaho. We're on the edge of our little straw mats here. We want to hear from you. Please describe. So here's the verse. Text 19. We never tire of hearing the transcendental pastimes of the personality of Godhead, who is glorified by hymns and prayers. Uttama Shloka Vikrame. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is glorified by hymns and prayers. Those who have developed a taste for the transcendental relationships with him relish hearing his pastimes at every moment. So, in the purport, I'm not going to read the whole thing. Prabhupada is doing the educational program of compare, contrast. So there's mundane literature and there's transcendental literature. Here's what mundane literature is like. Here's what transcendental literature is like. This is transcendental literature. So the mundane literature, he writes, mundane news is static, whereas transcendental news is dynamic, inasmuch as the spirit is dynamic and matter is static. That's important. Although there's a very beautiful prayer in the prayers by the demigods to Lord Krishna within the womb, that because we just observed Janmashtami, that's fresh in my mind. We read those prayers. The demigods are while Krishna is still within the womb of Devaki, he hasn't appeared yet, but he's about to appear, and they know it. And they're describing his transcendental position. They're describing his transcendental position by saying that you are the Antaryami. It's like, you know, the Lord of the heart. The indwelling supreme. And you're not only indwelling within the hearts of living entities, you're indwelling within every atom of matter. So the fact that life appears to be alive is only because of your presence. Like, you know, the trees and the birds and the living, you know, people and the living, just life, as opposed to dull matter. But even the non-moving beings, you're within, and your kindness is, you're going to make yourself seen by us. We're very eager to experience that, to experience your presence. So, if one doesn't have knowledge of spirit, or one doesn't have knowledge of Krishna, then all there is matter, and matter is static. So news about matter, it's stale. It doesn't have any taste, and yet people try to chew on that which doesn't have any taste. And because it doesn't have any taste, they go on to another one, 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 and endlessly go on to another thing that never brings any satisfaction. But because spirit is dynamic, when the subject matter is the dynamic force within matter that moves matter, that's fully conscious of matter, and etc., etc., even that it may appear to be a material subject, like Krishna takes his birth, Krishna does this, Krishna goes here, Krishna marries this one, and so on. Krishna is in the battle with that one, and it sounds material, but it's not, because it's dynamic. And the converse is, even it's an action movie or an action story, it's dull. How many, dull in the sense that here's Prabhupada's example. For example, anyone may read Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam repeatedly throughout his whole life and yet find in them new light of information. Those who have developed a taste for understanding the transcendental subject matter are never tired of hearing such narrations. Then the contrast, one is quickly satiated by mundane activities, but no one is satiated by transcendental or devotional activities. So, examples. Hour kirtan, or chanting 64 rounds, or something like that. How is it possible to do that unless there's something dynamic to involve oneself in that activity? It's not possible. Or it's just a show or something like that. If one, how many times, whatever the popular songs are, after some time and some time, you know, you've got to hear another song. As we know these arguments, but it's true. I watch people on planes, you know, their chewing gum program is something because it's boring, and so and after some time they gotta have another one, gotta have another one, because the taste is gone. They can't smoke a cigarette, so they chew chewing gum. But the taste is gone.
She took out the flight information thing and the pages were stuck with chewing gum. Just put it back. The safety pamphlet.
Yeah.
I got chewing gum, so I told her.
The classic example from our scriptures is sugar cane that's already had the juice removed. So somebody can pick up that sugar cane, they ran it through the machine so many times, or someone chewed it and spit it out. There's no juice. You know, it's just like, yuck. And that lifeless, tasteless subject matter, that's what material subject matter is. And so it ends up being trashed and you got to have another one. Whatever song or movie or book or magazine or newspaper, and then it's trashed and you got to get another one. And so, but with Prabhupada's point is, with spiritual activity, it's ever fresh. With Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's life, although he certainly heard that the Bhagavatam regularly, when he would go each day when he was living in Puri, he would go to the temple, see Lord Jagannath, receive prasad of Lord Jagannath, take that prasad to Haridas Thakur and associate with Haridas Thakur, and then he would go to the Gopinath temple. And with the Gopinath temple, he would sit and hear from Gadadhar Pandit the description of Srimad Bhagavatam from him. And after hearing again and again, he would say, after hearing the classic stories of Prahlad Maharaj or Dhruva Maharaj, hearing the whole story, he didn't say, "Oh, I've heard that before. Can you say something different?" He would say, Say it again. Say it again. And they would go on hundreds of times, according to Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami. Or when he was tasting the nectar of a particular verse that he was relishing, either saying it himself or having Ramananda Roy say it, he would hear it and he would experience such ecstasy. His message was, say it again, say it again. I have something over here. Etc. These are just examples of the nature of the Bhagavatam, because that's what's being spoken, the nature of topics in relation to Krishna. They're never stale. Even we've heard them, or Bhagavad Gita. It's not a story, it's just Bhagavad Gita. But because it's Krishna's words, new meaning transcendental literature is above the mode of darkness, and its light becomes more luminous by progressive reading and realization of the transcendental subject matter. So then Prabhupada completes the paragraph by going into, there's mundane, there's transcendental, and then he goes over to the impersonalists, the Aham Brahmasmi people. And he says, the so-called liberated persons are never satisfied by the repetition of the words Aham Brahmasmi. Aham Brahmasmi. Aham Brahmasmi. I mean, how many... What's going to happen from Aham Brahmasmi? They're going to have a 24-hour kirtan on Aham Brahmasmi? Or recite it again and again? So, what's the position? This question comes up from time to time. What's the position of those that have that attraction? Because Brahman realization, according to the Bhagavatam, is in a non-dual position. He's compared mundane literature, it's nescience. Bhagavat literature, it's transcendence. Brahman realization is also transcendence. It's a category of transcendence. Brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavaniti shabhyate. It's transcendence, but it's incomplete. And not only it's incomplete in the sense that it doesn't disclose where Brahman comes from, or what's the pratishtha, or the basis and support of Brahman. There's no mention of the personality of Godhead Bhagavan, and so the realization is incomplete. And not only is it incomplete, without acknowledgement of the personality of Godhead, there's no shelter. Like Prabhupada's example, you can go high, very high, high, high into the air. But unless you take shelter somewhere, you have to come back. So, into this realm of Brahman, but without shelter, and without shelter for the individual soul, what's that space or position of no shelter? It's uncomfortable. It's like, it's unnatural. It's not supersedity. So the supersedity comes when there's factual transcendental shelter. And the other is that largely the position of thinking of transcendence, just like Krishna describes in the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, avyakta murtina, those who meditate upon the unmanifest, unborn, impersonal, beyond form, beyond quality, it's very difficult. Practically speaking, it's not possible. But just to say it milder, it's very difficult. Very troublesome. And in the Brahma Samhita, there's a nice verse, we've heard this verse many times. But the last part is what I want to refer to. Pantasto koti shara vatsara sampragamyo vayora tapi manaso munipungavanam so pyasti yad prapadasinya vachincha tatve govindam adipurusham tamaham vajami. The verse is translated, I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, only the tip of the toe of whose lotus feet is approached by the yogis who aspire after the transcendental and betake themselves to pranayama by drilling the respiration, or by the jnanis who try to find out the non-differentiated Brahman by the process of elimination of the mundane, extending over thousands of millions of years. That's exhaustion. By not this, not this, not this, not this. Neti, neti. And that's the process of, one of the processes of impersonal speculation. What is Brahman? Brahman is not this, 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 not this. For thousands of millions of years. I mean, that's tasteless. Not this, not this, not this. So what is that happiness? The verse is, so pyasti yad prapada sinya vachincha tatve. Prapada, pada means foot, and prapada, Prabhupada is translated as, or excuse me, this is Bhaktisiddhanta, of the toe. And simni is the tip of the toe. At the tip of the toe, avachintya tatve. Avachintya is inconceivable or beyond the material conception. Seeking that happiness, that place of shelter, that's but the tip of the toe of the lotus feet of the Lord. At best, after thousands of millions of years. Who's going to do that? I don't know anybody that's going to do that. But even if they were to try to do that, the happiness that they would experience is not, it doesn't compare to the happiness of receiving the shelter of the personality of Godhead in the form of these narrations. So, Prabhupada writes, such artificial realization of Brahman becomes hackneyed. And so, to relish real pleasure, they turn to the narrations of Srimad Bhagavatam. That's those who are really fortunate. But then, those who are not so fortunate turn to altruism and worldly philanthropy. And that's a lot of people. I mean, there's just materialists that are like that, like good materialists, or frustrated impersonalists. They go to become enlightened and then leave that position of so-called enlightenment to come into the world and open schools and hospitals and welfare institutions, having declared it false. Now they engage themselves in those same activities. That means that the realization wasn't complete, which is the first point. And it's whatever it is that they've experienced, it's within the mind. Vimukta maninas, demonstrated by there's no shelter there, so they come to the material position again. This means that Mayavad philosophy is also mundane, whereas the philosophy of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam is transcendental. It's mundane for the speculators, and even for the Brahmavadis, we make the distinction between Mayavadi and Brahmavadi, and where are the Brahmavadis of today? They're Mayavadis that, by speculation, they wish themselves to become Brahman or God. And then the next purport Prabhupada addresses, that's also ludicrous, become God. Or even say to realize that you're God. That means, I'm God, I just forgot. What kind of God is that? No such thing. Excuse me, sir. But let me step hard on your foot, and when you say, ouch, then I'll understand you're not God. Beyond duality. So, the next verse. Lord Sri Krishna, the background is, the sages want to hear about the activities of the personality of Godhead. Now they're being very specific. They're asking about Krishna and Balaram. Lord Sri Krishna, the personality of Godhead, along with Balaram, who played like a human being, and so masked, performed many superhuman acts. They're making a declarative statement. They want to hear more. It's not like they never heard of Krishna. Oh, it's all new. Tell us something we never heard before. They've heard it. They've already stated. We never tire of hearing again and again. But you're so qualified. You've heard from Shukadeva. You've realized it. Please tell us again and again. And that's their underlining and put an exclamation point behind their question. Please describe those forms of the Lord as they appear in this world. So in the purport, Prabhupada chooses to speak about three things. One is, and they're all aimed towards the same thing, that Krishna is not, Krishna Katha is not mundane. Krishna is not mundane. His form is not mundane. His pastimes are not mundane, and therefore Krishna Katha is not mundane. He is described as Uttama Shloka. And Uttama Shloka means two things. It's the sloka, and it's the person described by the sloka. Just like the Bhagavatam is the book, and it's also the person. So Uttama Shloka, literally it means literature, Prabhupada is writing, not meant for nescience, or stated positively, literature that's meant for transcendence. And that literature meant for transcendence describes Uttama Shloka, the person who is described by choice poetry. But the poetry itself is transcendence, and the object of the poetry is transcendence. We can't say that about mundane things. Just like, you know, the distinction between the table and the word table. There's non-dual. This is the object, and then the word is different than the object. And the object is different than the word. But the poetry describing Krishna and Krishna are non-different. The Bhagavatam is non-different than Krishna. So then Prabhupada describes, second thing is that he writes, the doctrines of anthropomorphism and zoomorphism are never applicable to Krishna. What does that have to do with Krishna? What's anthropomorphism? Anthropomorphism is a doctrine, it's an ism, that says man imagines God to be like themselves. God is a creation of man in the likeness of man. We're like this, God is like super like us. So they just imagine creatively. And zoomorphism is the same idea, only God is like a certain animal. Oh, the deification of a bear, the deification of an eagle, or the American Indian, like an eagle feather or something. And there, you know, this represents the deity or God. Or waterfalls or something within nature. You know, like pantheism. Only it's zoomorphism. I mean, one projects an imagined deity or God figure as, you know, the big eagle or the big mountain or something. So, such doctrines are never applicable to Krishna. Krishna is not something imagined, in other words, or the other forms of Krishna that appear in this world. They're not created by imaginative people. Then he also writes, the theory that a man becomes God by dint of penances and austerities is very much rampant nowadays, especially in India. Then he gives, you know, expands on that. Well, since Lord Ram, Lord Krishna, Lord Chaitanya were detected by the sages and saints to be the personality of Godhead, as indicated in revealed scriptures, many unscrupulous men have created their own incarnations. The process of concocting an incarnation of God has become an ordinary business, especially in Bengal, but not only in Bengal. You don't need to give examples. There's examples. Because by austerities and penances that are exceptional, one may develop some mystic power, and by exhibiting some mystic power, somebody thinks somebody's God. A nice one to make reference to is Bhishika Singh during the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He lived in outside of Puri, and he was claiming he was an incarnation of Krishna. And his brother was Balaram. And Balaram would go into Puri and invite the ladies to come and enjoy rasa dance with Krishna. Because here's this mystic Bhishika Singh. And they believed it, because they were naive. And he was polluting the ladies of Puri, you know, high-class ladies, in the name of, I'm Krishna, you're the gopis, and we'll have our enjoyment together. Bhaktivinoda Thakur stopped him. But he had mystic powers, and because he had mystic powers, people thought, oh, he must be true. He's God. Then Prabhupada describes, here's the pastimes of Krishna and Balaram. And he moved from Mathura to Gokula, and he performed childhood pastimes with Mother Jasoda and Nanda Maharaj, and they seem quite, besides attractive, they also seem quite human. His specific pastimes, all this becomes known as one's reading of the literature progresses. It is important to note, however, that the Lord exhibited his divinity even from the lap of his mother, that his deeds are superhuman. He lifted the Govardhan Hill at the age of 7. There's a nice little mountain outside the window. Go have a 7-year-old go pick up the mountain. And that all these acts definitely prove him to be actually the personality of Godhead. Yet, due to his mystic covering, he was always accepted as an ordinary human child by his so-called father and mother and other relatives. Whatever Herculean task was performed by him, the father and mother took it otherwise, and they remained satisfied with unflinching filial love for their son. As such, this is the last sentence, the sages of Naimisharanya describe him as apparently resembling a human being, but actually he is the Supreme, Almighty Personality and Godhead. So that's the theme, and they're asking the sages, they're not interested in mythology and storytelling and imaginative stuff. They want transcendental life. They're transcendentalists. But so they're describing him as Gudha, G-U-D-H-A, Gudha. He was masked. Kapata Manasa, apparently a human being. So he, by his internal potency, appeared to be worldly. But they're appreciating not at all worldly, amplifying from the previous verses. Otherwise, we'd be satiated. We heard that already. That's your another one. But new and new light, newer and newer light is coming. So his pastimes are fully transcendental. That's what the sages want to hear, and they want to hear from the qualified person who can describe them. And Yenatma superseded to be fully satisfied by their hearing. Okay. Krishna, Krishna. Discussion? Yeah. Matter is not alive. The point that the demigods are making is the appearance of things being alive is because the presence of Krishna. Although matter is dead matter. So we appear to be alive only because the presence of the soul and the direction of the soul by supersoul. But otherwise, the body is dull matter. And the material conception doesn't consider the soul and the supreme soul within. The transcendentalist, like the demigods, were appreciating, even within matter, the appearance of it being alive as much as there's life within this world is because of your presence. The particular appreciation is now, and now you're going to come out of hiding and show yourself. But the earlier is, your presence goes undetected. And because of your presence, it appears that matter is alive. But matter isn't alive. Matter is dead matter. So illusion is given facility by Krishna's presence, by being within everything.
That's why Prahlad Maharaj saw Krishna in
exactly. The Gulf. Exactly. And when he was asked by Hiranyakashipu, where is Vishnu? His answer was, he's everywhere, Father. Oh, he's everywhere. Then he's in this pillar, is that right? Yes, Father, he's in the pillar. He's everywhere. But although he's everywhere, the materialist can't see him anywhere, and he's everywhere, so the devotee can appreciate he's everywhere. Even in the back country, he's... not especially he's in the back country, but even...
The other question? down to the, you know, material enjoyment, it's like, it's like,
yeah,
true over and over again. I'm thinking, I mean, you kind of know that if you hear that, but still, there's some juice, even if it's like, you know, true it over and over again, but initially there's some sweetness to material enjoyment. And so how do we kind of not consider this anymore? How do we develop this higher taste?
Well, it's not that there's enjoyment. It's well, there's two, one can say it in either one of two ways. It's a reflection only. You know, is there reality in a reflection? The answer is there's not reality in a reflection. It's just a reflection. You know, here's a mirror, and here's an apple, and I'm hungry, so I see in the mirror an apple. But there's no substance. It's right here in the very beginning verse of the Bhagavatam and the purport. There's no substance. So, is there happiness in sense gratification? There's no substance. But what is there? If there's no substance, it's illusion. That which we call happiness is illusion. Well, come on, you know, there's people do things because they're getting something. Otherwise, they wouldn't do something. They would do nothing. But they're doing something. They're, let's say, you know, the classic is, even aside from human beings, in all species of life, male-female attraction is there. Otherwise, life would stop. It's there. There's an attraction. But what is that attraction? We, you know, on the way in, there's this big mama bear and her two little cubs. So, there's some attraction. What is that attraction? It's a reflection of the real thing. So people are pursuing, like the mirage, the classic that Prabhupada would repeat so many times, the animal, because he's an animal, he doesn't know there's no water in the desert, but he sees the reflection of water, and so he pursues. That it's that expectation of happiness is what people are pursuing. And there is, certainly there's some sensation, but what does Krishna call that sensation? Yehi samsparshaja bhoga dukkha Yonaya Evate. There's a sensation, samsparsha ja, that the contact of the sense with the sense object. That's what it is. Is it happiness? Nope. What is it? It's the reflection of happiness. There is such a thing as real happiness, but that's not it. What is it? It's a reflection of happiness. Well, what's the real thing then? The real thing is Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam. That's what the real thing is. So persons are chasing after. That's one answer, a valid answer to your, you know, the perplexity. Realize there is nothing substantial in the material world. I mean, that's what a transcendent, an impersonalist transcendentalist certainly goes for that one. But then, a devotee should also. Then, what is there? What's reality? And you pursue reality instead of illusion. Then you can find real happiness. Another answer, we'll spend much less time on the other answer. The other answer is, it's insignificant. That happiness of material sense pleasure is insignificant. We can say, so the two possibilities are, it doesn't even exist. It exists as an illusion. It's not what real happiness is. Or the other is, it's insignificant. So to realize either one, then that helps one go down the path of making the right choice instead of the wrong choice, the choice of reality instead of the choice of illusion. So your question is, you know, it looks real, and the people are pursuing it, and the world is pursuing it. What to do? Associate with transcendental knowledge so that one can realize it's either insubstantial or insignificant nature to help to make the right choice. And even better is experience spiritual happiness through the direct activities of devotional service in prescribed manners. So that will, that happiness doesn't, material happiness can't compare to it. It makes the choice easier. Receive Krishna's mercy and it makes the choice easier. A great example is King Chitraketu. His obsession with having a son, and the nature of that obsession was even receiving the son was the source of his misery, which by the son's dying or being killed. So then he was ready to receive transcendental knowledge by having the channel of the happiness of sense gratification taken away, or the illusion that there's happiness out there. When the illusion is smashed, then one can accept transcendental knowledge or the happiness of relationship with Krishna.
This morning I was reading in the third canto, Prabhupada, some woman who goes after giving devotee to Kanta Muni, and then describing how some woman who was enjoying materialistic life, but in Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada saying that material life involved with the Krishna consciousness is okay, that I need more.
That's not what he said.
That's not what he said. But he said material life in Krishna, same moment, purport Prabhupada says about
the message of the Bhagavatam is pure devotional service. And pure devotional service means no mix. That's, you know, anyabhilashita shunyam jnana karma janavratam. That's the message of the Bhagavatam. And because Devahuti was married to such a qualified person, and she was attracted to be married to such a qualified person, she had as her son the personality of Godhead. That's not mundane anything. Now, is it possible, like Lord Brahma, who achieved full realization and yet still had a desire for material activity, namely creating a universe, or for us it's whatever it is, how can those two fit together? The two fit together if the answer of Lord Vishnu gives is by joining those activities of this world with direct activities of devotion, like hearing and chanting. So that's not our position. We're in the sadhana position. We're not in the realized position, as Lord Brahma was. But through careful sadhana, aiming at exclusive shelter in Krishna, because we're following Rupa Goswami, who says that's what we should do, and we accept that, then we can navigate our way through that very difficult and treacherous territory called living in the material world while aspiring for the transcendental shelter of Krishna. So I'd like to see the exact wording that Prabhupada gave that says, we'll do that when we get back. Anything else? little Bhagavatam class in the backwoods. A little different than your every morning, huh?
Another reminder, just in the current Newsweek article, that most of Americans are being Hindus, presuming Hindus.
Well, you read that article.
Yes,
So what does it mean? It's not like they're becoming...
No, it means awful.
Huh?
For me, it means awful. It's a pantheism. They're just believing anything.
Yeah, anything. That's what the article means.
Nonsense.
Yeah.
In the name of pantheism.
Well, it's written from a Christian perspective. And so, as Hindus say, yatamatatupat, the Christians are saying yatamatatupat.
Yeah.
So, the Christians are becoming Hindus. That's what it was meant.
Yeah,
but not, it's not, you know, it's no. not an attraction for Vaishnavas to say, oh, Yatama Tatupat is becoming, you know, a very popular view in America today. Instead of being a fundamentalist Christian, they're, you know, liberal, broad-minded Christians. There are many paths, there are many ways. That was what that article was, in a nutshell. Something. How are you going to see Krishna out here? There's a very nice... In the prayers of the demigods, I'll find the verse and point it out to you. But Prabhupada is giving an answer to the statement that he made when he said, when you're Krishna conscious... And you see a tree, you don't just see the tree, you see Krishna there. Rabindra Sarup Prabhu narrates very wonderfully in his inimitable style that when he was a philosophy PhD aspirant and heard Prabhupada say that, he deeply puzzled over that. He took it like a Zen koan, that, you know, you don't see the tree, you see Krishna. What does that mean? Did he like not see the tree, but he saw Krishna? Like, you know, what does it mean? Or he just saw that's the energy of Krishna? What did he mean? So it's more than just see the energy and looking out the window and seeing the trees. It's more than just seeing the energy of Krishna. It's not exactly seeing the universal form of Krishna. The trees are his hairs and his body, and the mountains are his stacks of bones, and the rivers, we have all that right here, are the veins, because Krishna has no veins and Krishna has no bones, and so on. But that's imaginative. It's not imaginative. It's everything is because of the, in this simple setting, the mode of goodness is elevated, and the mode of passion is diminished, although it's still here, and the mode of ignorance is diminished, although it's still here. So in the feature of goodness, to, in that quality of goodness, hear the message of the Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, in that very receptive mode that allows one to see beyond the physical manifestation, the veneer, the covering, and appreciate the mightiness of Krishna, the majesty of Krishna. And the majesty of Krishna in this world is but a fragment of his splendor. Like the opposite chapter, and Bhagavad Gita is a very good way of taking advantage of being in this setting. The power, the might, the majesty, and how fragile our situation is in this material world. You know, deflating our pride and conquering of nature and so on. Because what the modern world has managed to do is create that illusion very, very nicely. We have this nice, safe home with the nice, safe, this and that, and no bugs, no beasts, and we're protected and safe. And a little tornado comes through and... In the Tiger Center's neighborhood, a tornado went through, and homes just down the street are no longer there. That safety was, in a flash, completely gone. So the illusion of that safety is that, on the door, if there's a bear, this is what you do. If there's a fire, this is what you do. Although it's nice, we're at risk at every moment. And we're feeling ourselves dependent upon Krishna. So taking advantage of the mode of goodness situation that you're in, feel the presence of Krishna. Like we saw this little video of the people that climbed Mount Kimbi, and I heard it 5 times. Respect. Respect for the mountain. Respect for God who has created it is behind respect for the mountain. So, in those kinds of ways, that the mode of goodness is a great facility for God realization. But most people aren't prepared to live like that. Even what we're doing is there's modern comforts, like you were describing, with plumbing. Yesterday you were busy, taking care of one of those plumbing problems, the pump. I attended a japa retreat in Sharanagati. Have you heard of that place? And although I was there just for 2.5 days, the japa retreat, certainly, the 64 rounds was a big part of it, but the atmosphere was another big part of it. Just, to be off the grid, there's no electricity, no phones, no cell phones, they're like here. It's conducive to go more deeply in spiritual practice and the message of Scripture. So while you're here, although you know what the Scripture says because you're a teacher, you know what it says, but read in a receiving mode, chant in a receiving mode, and you'll get a lot of spiritual from that conducive atmosphere that's surrounding you. And one of the thoughts that I've had since being here is this would be a great place to have a bunch of devotees come and spend 4 months together and, have part of the day a hearing and chanting program, along with taking care of the guests and doing the stuff. Fantastic. Got to find the right people, but if you find the right people, it'd be fantastic.